Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration
and energy. I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
The void is a spatial notion. And when we think about it, it has many misconceptions. It can be considered to be an empty space. Vacuous, a space of abandon, neglect, when actually this exhibition is saying quite the opposite, that the void is always occupied by something. It might be unnamed or unknown, but it has intention and significance.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. My old aunties used to say the silences are more important than the words, and it's a reminder that what might be seen as empty in one culture might have much deeper meanings in another. And this evening we bring you a special program where we discuss a new exhibition curated by Emily McDaniel that explores this very idea. The exhibition is titled Void, and it includes the works of Ghana artist James Tyler and Budawong and Nguyen artist and designer Daniel Romick. Emily McDaniel, James Tyler and Daniel Romick join me now. Welcome to Speaking Out.
Thank you.
Before exploring the exhibition itself, I'd like to explore a little bit of what's brought each of you to your own creative practice. So let's start with you, Emily. Can you tell us a bit about where you grew up and what your influences were?
Yeah, so I'm a Wiradjuri woman from the Kalari clan, the Lachlan River clan in central New South Wales, and I've grown up in Liverpool my whole life. I never really thought I'd end up in visual art. I didn't think of it as visual art. For me, it was culture, and that's what I knew and what I was passionate about. And so as I left school, I found myself working at the Art Gallery of New South Wales as a educator and sharing those stories. And since then, my practice has developed and I work as a curator, writer and educator. But more so what I'm finding is that perhaps those categories aren't the categories we need to share our stories. So I'm now thinking of my practice as a storyteller, and I hope that's what Void is. It tells a story, allowing people to finish that story themselves.
It's obvious in your work how important your Wiradjuri heritage is as an influence to you and your creative life. I was just wondering in relation to perhaps how influential your father was. I know he himself makes possum coats and has also been deeply immersed in language. So it does seem like it's a very vibrant part of the way that your family interacts.
Absolutely. I think it's no surprise that both my father, my brother and I all work within Indigenous knowledge in many different ways, in law, in governance, in education, in creative expression. So for me, that's kind of ingrained in my being. And I notice that as I get older, I start to talk a bit like him as well. I start to have those pauses. And I notice that his words have become my own and they resurface in really interesting ways in the projects that I do.
James, you have a wonderful range of heritages, including Ghana. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what they are and how they've influenced your sense of who you are and your creative practice.
Yeah, so I was born in Mildura, where my parents met. My mum is Ghana and European Australian, and my dad is Maori and European Australian. My mum grew up in Broken Hill and moved down to Mildura, and my dad came from a farm in Portland and moved up to Mildura also to work on grape vineyards, and then I was born. And they both tried to instill in me like a strong sense of identity. And then they actually split up, but I kept in contact a lot with my dad, who comes in and out of my life like throughout my, I'm 30 now. So every year I'd go down and visit him at the farm. So I kind of was engaging with a lot of my different backgrounds. So I then, like, my mum moved up to Menindee, which is in far west New South Wales. And we lived on a farm and went to school there. And And then my mum worked for the local land council in Menindee, and then she took a job with ATSIC in the Kimberley, and we moved up there, which was really kind of an amazing space to grow up in. And then she later took another job in Darwin and moved across there with her. And then I was old enough to leave home. And then I kind of went off to Europe and worked as a carpenter. And then I kind of came back, and I was around that 20 year old, and I was kind of looking at my heritage a little bit, what I wanted to do. And I kind of decided I'd be a war journalist because I was interested in photography, wasn't happy with being a carpenter. Moved to Adelaide, and sort of moving to Adelaide really kind of was jarring for me. I grew up Menindee and Kununurra and Derby in the Kimberley. They're quite mixed culturally, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And I was sort of interested in, like, when I moved to Adelaide, it's very European, and that sort of, I started to look at my own heritage, and we grew up knowing that we're Indigenous, and we always kind of referred to being like from down south when we were in the Kimberley, and we didn't really know exactly where our family was from. And I moved into my grandmother's house while I was studying at university. I lived with her for the last 10 years before just recently moving to Canberra. And I started to quiz my gran a bit because she's not necessarily forthcoming. She's a little bit reserved, and I think it's the era that she grew up in. And we started talking a little bit more, and it took a little bit. And she hasn't been so reluctant with my mother and my aunties about like telling the story about our Indigenous ancestry. And so she sort of brought these stories out, and I became more and more interested, and we found out like that my family comes from around Balaclava, which is about 100 k's north of Adelaide. So it kind of located my Kaurna ancestry. And I guess being in Adelaide, it's also Kaurna, so it really kind of gave me the opportunity to explore my Kaurna heritage, which is what I've kind of done for the last 5 years.
Can I just ask you, obviously you've just mentioned very briefly that you were, when you were considering that being a war correspondent, you were drawn to photography. It's obviously a very big part of your creative practice. Can you just talk us a little bit more about how that became such a focus for you in terms of, you know, how you're capturing what you want to say?
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I can't really explain in living in Adelaide, realising that a lot of people in the visual arts came from an upper middle class family. I came from a relatively poor family, and, you know, we didn't, you know, growing up in country towns, you know, it comes also with having a bit of a rough upbringing. So I kind of was drawn to war journalism because I mean, conflict was very much a regular part of country life. Especially with problems within Indigenous communities and within our own family with substance abuse and stuff like that, I was kind of felt like I wouldn't be scared going into a war zone. And then I decided to pursue that. But then when I moved to Adelaide, I kind of realised that, like, the things that are not talked about is the conflict that's happening at home rather than the conflict that's happening abroad. So I felt like I wanted to look at that and look at the conflict and where that comes from. And so, like, a lot of my practice looks at frontier violence because that's really where the kind of disruptions happen within in contemporary communities that are sort of bring a lot of violence to the surface. It can be violence within our own communities, violence to other communities, or communities' violence towards us being non-Indigenous to Indigenous. So I was kind of wanted to talk about that, and being in Adelaide, not many people know about those stories, and they're confronting to people, but I think that they need to know about them. And so I kind of wanted to, like, looking at my Kaurna ancestry, that the conflict really happened in Adelaide and expanded out and took over the Kaurna nation. So I really wanted to make people aware that, like, this trauma comes from a place, and it comes from a place that we've all inherited, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And some people get, you know, the benefits and the privilege of living on this land and having it dispossessed, and other people have the disadvantage of having it dispossessed. So those are things that I really wanted to bring forward. And I guess I still am kind of a war journalist in some extent, I think.
Danielle, tell us a bit about your background and how that's influenced your path to engaging in creative practice.
Somehow all of my brother and sister and I have ended up in a spatial disciplines, though we all started quite differently and we don't have parents in that in those disciplines at all. So we all work together quite well, which is interesting. I started in fashion, though, in London. I had my own little business over there and was plodding along quite well for some years and then got quite sick and had to come home and start again pretty much. And in that transition of moving from, you know, London to back to Sydney, I had to relook at my own story and my own identity and went back to university and became qualified as a spatial designer. And spatial design sits between architecture, public art, urban design and interior design. And so you can go quite a lot of directions with that. My interests are in performative design. So how do we perform in spaces, but also how do we design spaces that people can perform in, be that a stage or a living room or a public space? And my sort of looking into that as an Aboriginal person or an Aboriginal woman even became quite key. It's through my PhD research, in which I'm nearly finishing, which is great. Looking at how do we Aboriginal people inhabit, know, love, sense, dream our spaces, and how have we always done so, and how have our spaces through colonisation become traumatised, but then how can we reclaim them? And one of the ways that I think they can be reclaimed is through our cultural practice. And I have a number of cultural practices, and one of those is weaving, but also I think my spatial practice spatial practices leads through to a cultural practice because of the various methods that I've used and probably had passed on to me, definitely had passed on to me from my family without really knowing that they were being passed on, you know, things like walking country and sensing and listening to country.
One thing I do very much like about your work is that you can really get the sense that you think very deeply about the space you're working with. Yeah. And, you know, obviously that comes through in a range of different ways, but I'm thinking particularly about the work you did on Cockatoo Island. And I was just wondering if you can just tell us what draws you to a particular project and what processes you might use to interpret the space around it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the work out on Cockatoo Island is site specific to that place, and that's often one of the things that draws me to working on a project is the site specificity of that place, which includes, of course, all the things that come with that place. You know, the materials, the stories, the knowledge, the landscape, the flora, the fauna, and how that's experienced by us as people who move through those spaces and engage with it. Emily and I were actually talking and she says, oh, your work's quite different. And she's right. When you look across my work, it is all quite different, but the underlying methods have remained the same for a very long time. And so that's speculation, which, and I call, there's a design practice called speculative design, where you're asking questions like what might be, and part of I guess I'm trying to dream up what might be a possible future. How can we dream this up better? How can we dream our future up better? And so yeah, that it's to do with also. I'm also very interested in urban Aboriginal experiences, and so how are we in cities which are still located on country, experiencing country as Aboriginal people, and how do we continue our practices and our culture in a city space, which often has been perceived as being sort of devoid of country, but in reality we know that's not true. We know that country's in the city, and it's just maybe harder to hear in the same way. Now, I don't mean hear it in your ears, but hear it in your chest and in your stomach, you know. And maybe we don't walk it in the same way, but we still do. So those are the sorts of things that I'm quite interested in exploring and have explored for some time.
That sounds like a great segue to get into the exhibition. Now, Emily, the title of this new exhibition that you've curated, which has both James and Danielle's work in it, is titled Void. Can you tell us what drew you to this concept?
I first started thinking about this exhibition about 5 or 6 years ago, and I was observing Aboriginal contemporary art practice, and I noticed that there was a commonality in the expression of many artists, and it was around this idea of what the void is. And the void is a spatial notion, and when we think about it, it has many misconceptions. It can be considered to be an empty space, vacuous, a space of abandon, neglect, when actually this exhibition is saying quite the opposite, that the void is always occupied by something. It might be unnamed or unknown, but it has intention and significance. And so each artist in this exhibition has a very different articulation of that concept. The void can be a political tool that has been used against us, you know, declaring our lands terra nullius, devaluing our connection to country, declaring our relationships void. It's also something we occasionally use as a form of censorship, perhaps to protect our cultural knowledge. We conceal it. We make sure that it's outside of someone's reach. And so there are many facets to this concept. And I think it's important that with this exhibition, we resolve that there is no resolution of what this concept can be. But there are so many manifestations of it beyond just the work of contemporary artists. The void, the space in between, those pauses we take when we're talking about something significant and important. Those pauses aren't because we don't have words to say. It's because we want those words that we say to have significance and meaning. You know, when we look to our night sky, Western astronomy is predominantly centred on the stars themselves. They hold the meaning and the significance, when for us it's the space in between. That negative space actually tells those stories, you know, of the great emu. That significant space is really important to us, and it's a way of inviting people to see what we see and to think how we think and to understand what we understand.
We're going to get a chance to hear from both Danielle and James about their work in the exhibition in depth, but can you just maybe give us a bit of an overview of the other artists you've included in the exhibition?
The exhibition includes really diverse artists, and I think that's testament to the prevalence of this concept in many artists' practice. We have a beautiful story pot by Dr. Gloria Thankupi Fletcher, who's now passed. And evocatively, she calls these pots her story pots. They're big and clunky and graphic. They've been incised into the surface of the pot, and I was looking at them and starting to think, maybe it's not just the story that's engraved inside, but rather metaphorically and speculatively, we can imagine that those stories are contained inside those vessels, that she leaves slightly open so we can see what might be within them. We've got work by Mabel Jawley, a Gidjah artist, and her beautiful iconographic black and white works. John Mowangel, Andy Snellgar, Josephine and Jennifer Workich, Jonathan Jones, Hayley Miller-Baker. So it's an incredibly diverse exhibition, and that's done with purpose, because it really is a bit of an equation, the exhibition. This plus this what's the conversation that it creates?
Danielle, your piece in the exhibition is untitled, but not surprising given what you've said already about your practice and what interests you and where you've really trained in your creative practice. It's very structural and very architectural. Can you tell us about what you're exploring with the pieces?
Yeah, I was. It was a speculative drawing, I guess you could say, and I was looking at an experimental piece of architecture by Eisenman, Peter Eisenman. It's this piece of architecture is in the States, and it's situated in a fairly barren site where there's no trees, and it's kind of the site itself you can't see much around the house. The questions I was asking in this was really simple. It was, what if I drew this house as a dark space? So how would it be if this was in darkness and devoid of human, though with suggestions, I guess, that there maybe were people there at some point? But also, what if I did the best drawing I ever did? Was the other question. In that drawing process, I went into this sort of meditative space, and I just sat down and drew those drawings fairly quickly in some ways. And in that process, somehow they created voids, and they created this sort of, structural weirdness, which implies there's people around, but they're not really there, and implies darkness beyond where you can see. And it was just me being very methodical and careful about how to draw the best drawing I could ever draw, and responding to fairly ambiguous ideas around the architecture itself and into the original design of that building, and somehow these void spaces got created, which need to be seen over light, which is interesting, in order that you can see them. Which is why it's in a light box.
Actually, I have to say, one of the things that struck me about your work, which is, of course, very modern and takes on challenges a Western form of design architecture, but you've got this beautiful series of very, very, very delicate lines. And actually, when I was looking at your drawings, I thought they actually were quite, there was a stylistic element in them that was quite like John Moangel's work, the bark painting. And I was just wondering, especially when you talk about the fact that it kind of came through a kind of stream of consciousness, how much do you really think about, I guess, a more traditional art practice or Indigenous motifs? Or do you just sort of feel like they come through unconsciously in that way?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't planned, but you're right, it comes through nonetheless. Those patterns that come through the, very trying to keep a very even hand, but somehow you get a different pressure irrespective. Maybe you put the pen down and, go and get a cup of tea, and then you come back and you have a different pressure. All of a sudden, it suddenly creates this variation, which is very much like more traditional paint work. And I don't think it came from me deciding that. It's how it came out. And it's happened before where I've gone, oh, gosh, that's not what I was trying to do, but it came out like that. It came out with these sort of somehow more traditional seeming expressions. But I don't know, maybe it's somewhere in there that I can't, in a space that I can't really describe. And know where it comes from.
In a way, I guess it's a testament to Emily's curatorial skills that she's managed to kind of put the two on parallel walls. So you sort of see yours, and then you can look over and see the other and think, oh, there's almost a connection there that we don't see ourselves. Now, James, you've got a series of works in the exhibition as well. Deleted scenes from an untouched landscape and erased scenes from an untouched landscape are beautiful photographic landscapes, but then you've carved space or a void out of or into them, whichever way you want to look at it. Can you tell us about what you're seeking to express in terms of the concept of void in those works?
Yeah. I guess, so the void for me is sort of, it's kind of representing something that's not there. I guess growing up in the country and traveling a lot between places like Menindee to Portland, where my dad lives, or traveling through the Kimberley with my mum between like Broome and Derby or Kununurra and Wyndham and or up to Darwin, you kind of see that there's not much representation of Aboriginal culture. It's more farming landscapes and it's more that European narrative. So I guess for me, I kind of like moving down to Adelaide and living around there and travelling around that space, it's very European farms, old colonial buildings, contemporary ones as well, but I kind of didn't see much Kaurna representation. There's a few canoe trees, scar trees, but really there's not a lot of Kaurna representation around the city, out in the peripheral, up and up when you go up north onto the plains and stuff. You don't see anything. It's just farms. So I kind of, when I began making the work, I was looking at that erasure, that removal of Aboriginal culture in these spaces. But I guess, like, it's become, because the series I've been making it over a five-year period, and there's, like, vanished scenes and removed scenes as well, as erased and deleted. It's been this ongoing kind of exploration of going to places, places particularly in the southeast of Australia, but also around South Australia. And I guess my perspective comes from my Kaurna perspective where, you know, we're colonised by the South Australian Company and they had a set amount of plans about how they were going to colonise South Australia. They sold all the land off before they got there and essentially they basically removed everybody off the land so farmers could take it up. And the first mission was set up in South Australia. So Wibberlina in Tasmania was the very first, but the first kind of we're going to make a mission was in Adelaide on the golf course. And Aboriginal people from that very point in South Australia started getting removed off the land. And it really, as I started to do the research in the British parliamentary papers on colonisation of South Australia, I started to see that there was this deliberate erasure of my Kaurna culture, other Noongar people from South Australia's removal. But then that same narrative sort of seemed to take place across the nation. So it was kind of talking from my own perspective as an Aboriginal person, but also as a non-Aboriginal person, as someone who has colonial ancestry from New South Wales, Tasmania and Victoria and South Australia. I kind of wanted to sort of be aware that both as an Aboriginal person, I'm bringing this kind of story to the front, but I'm also doing it as a non-Indigenous person, saying that my colonial farming ancestors also removed people. So, yeah, it means a lot of different things, that void and what it represents, the thing that it's actually something missing, but I'm trying to represent something in that absence, yeah.
Actually, I think the other thing that strikes me listening to you talk about how you think audiences will have a different view and take different things from it. When I first looked at the works, I actually thought they were sculptural objects in the landscape. And only when I got closer did I see that you'd actually carved out, cut out, removed part of the image. So there was almost an optical illusion. So how I felt about what I was seeing changed as I walked towards it. Is that a deliberate attempt to challenge audiences with what they're seeing in your works?
Yeah, well, I guess I come from a photography background, so I really wanted to represent this thing that was missing, and the only way I really knew how to was to remove it. And I specialise in 19th century photographic processes, and one of them is the ambrotype. And the ambrotype is this image on a glass, and behind it you put a piece of black velvet, and you rather like, the cheap way of doing it for peasants would be to paint it with tar, but for the more like wealthier colonial people used to have a nice piece of black velvet because velvet takes out absolute light. So as I was going through the process of removing this circle out of the paper, I was like, how can I make it so you can never ascertain this bit of lost knowledge again, was to have this black void. I mean, as an Aboriginal person who comes from a background that has been colonised and had, you know, been our families have been completely removed off country onto somebody else's country on missions and being servants on farms and stuff, it's kind of this thing that I've been trying to represent is this erasure. Though I've been able to get some knowledge back, there is stuff that we'll never know. There's stories that we'll never know. So I kind of wanted the viewer to be able to look at this kind of sculptural thing that had been moved that they could never ascertain. They could never know what was behind that picture, and kind of know what I felt when I was feeling absence of culture. Yeah.
Thanks, James. James Tyler is the Kaurna artist whose works are featured in the exhibition Void. And you've also been listening to curator with the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney, Emily McDaniel, and Bundawong and Yuin artist and designer, Danielle Romick. The Void exhibition is on show at the UTS Gallery in Sydney until the 16th of November.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
Keep that tradition going and share it on to the younger generation.
The world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, Radio National, Radio Australia, on podcast and the ABC Radio app. I'm Larissa Berendt. When you consider the concept of a void, you may think of an empty space or simply see nothing. Our guests this evening have been asked to conjure their own ideas around the theme and place them in the public sphere to open a discussion on the subject. The works of visual artists James Tyler and Danielle Romick examine the themes of cultural identity and of Indigenous understanding of space. They join curator Emily McDaniel on our panel discussion this evening, centred on the exhibition currently being shown at the UTS Gallery in Sydney, simply titled Void. Emily, curating is about, as we've said, pulling together a seemingly eclectic group of pieces to see some thematics, some contrasts, connections, juxtapositions. What are some of the philosophies you use when you're seeking to pull together an exhibition like this?
For me, it starts with listening and observing, which is an endless pursuit. And through that process, when you're aware, those ideas really present themselves. You know, the artists in this exhibition, we have works from 1980 through to now, which tells us that this isn't a trend. This isn't a fad. The void isn't something that we're just starting to understand or express. It's something that we've been looking at for an incredibly long time. So that's really where the process starts and ends for me. And once the exhibition is on, that listening and observing doesn't stop. It in fact starts to ricochet. And those ideas inform the next iteration of this exhibition, which will be touring nationally. So that constant cycle of listening, observing, responding is really important.
James, I just want to come back on something that's a very big theme in your work, and you spoke about your inspirations, and it was really about the role in which your work can play in having a national conversation about history, those broad, important national conversations. And I was wondering if you could maybe describe for us what you see as the role of the artist in those important conversations. And is that role different for an Indigenous artist?
Yeah, I think as an Indigenous artist, there seems to be a weight, almost like a sort of responsibility that comes with educating non-Indigenous people. Not every Indigenous person has that mode, but I feel there's a large obligation. There's obligation to community as well as obligation to a wider community that is not your own. And I guess that's we kind of live in this nation state that is Australia. Obviously there's other nation states, being Kaurna, as other people have different nation states and different ways of identifying. But I think, there's definitely a way that to try to make the general public in Australia aware of our kind of the national narrative. I mean, national narratives are very simplistic in in many ways. And it's, I think as a Kaurna person, I always try to come back to the South Australian narrative as a basis, which has its own stories that are different to other stories that have taken place across, you know, a vastly different cultures, landscapes that is Australia. But I think there are some things that have happened that are blanket, you know. There was the White Australia policy, racial segregation, frontier wars. Those things happen in a very across the nation, and they are very kind of simple things that you look at, but then there's these underneath that, there's these stories. And I guess when people view my work, I guess I want them to, they're kind of ambiguous, they're not it's just this void in the work that people kind of look at, and they create their own narratives and their own relationship between those colonial narratives that are happening in places where they've grown up. And you know, because my story isn't everybody's story. So I kind of want people to think about that. But I guess what would come up in artist talks or interviews and stuff like that is that these circles that that I put over the land or taken out of the landscape are signifiers to conversations about what's happened in those spaces. And in a lot of the pictures, some are I'm less removed for. Sometimes I'm travelling in between spaces where I've taken a picture of something, but there's ones where there's actually quite hideous stories underneath the surface of it. But then sometimes because I'm looking at such a heavy content, I sometimes just remove out things from the scenes, like farmers' houses is a little kind of like, yeah, you can be erased too, as a kind of comforting thing. But yeah, it's just looking at how that history can be erased, and that can be looked at on a national level, which is a conversation I think needs to happen across the nation, which is happening and seems to be happening a lot more in the last 10 years. Well, it's been happening ever since 67 onwards, but it had been happening prior to that as well. But that's kind of when it started to grow momentum. But it seems to be with the idea of a national identity towards reconciliation, these conversations are starting to surface. And, you know, there are exhibitions acknowledging frontier wars and stuff like that, and memorials going up. So I think as an artist, there's a role to bring those stories to the forefront. Yeah.
Danielle, it's not easy crafting a career in the creative industries, but you've done that for yourself. And I was just wondering, what advice would you give to somebody who might be considering such a path, and particularly based on perhaps some of the things that you've really had found as challenges in your own experience and had to overcome?
Yeah, it is challenging. And, you know, there aren't many people you can look to see, oh, how did they do it yet? And I'm always hopeful that there'll be new designers and creatives coming up through various systems, be they university or otherwise. I'm really tired of having to say this word, but resilience is so important. I wish we didn't have to be resilient. I almost feel resentful about having had to have been resilient. But it's formed my practice in a way that it wouldn't have been formed otherwise. So I'm very grateful to it as well. So stick with it, and you know, keep despite it all, find ways through it. Find ways to connect to your own cultural practice and own design practice or creative practice, whatever that might be, which are going to keep you grounded and, you know, centered on country, I guess, if you want to put it like that, in community and with family, because that really helped me a lot when I was having particular challenges, being able to go back to family and saying, I can't cope with this, and they, you know, scoop you up and put you under their wing for however long you need to be put there. My family do that, which is lovely. I guess the other thing is, don't be afraid to experiment and try different things, because you never know what's going to come out of it. That work out on Cockatoo Island came from some very small experiments I was doing with concrete, which had, you know, really nothing to them. It was just, how do I make this concrete work and stick in a form that I want it to stick in? And in that process, this huge spatial map came out, you know, a little while down the track, along with my brother and sister, who without them I couldn't have done that we couldn't have done that work without each other. But yeah, I think experimenting with all different sorts of materials, like we've got materials that came from here, but we've got materials that, you know, didn't come from here now as well. Materials of country, materials not of country is what I call them. And sometimes you need to find how they're going to work together or how they're going to comment off of each other. Like, this works like this, but without this, it doesn't work like, you know, ask those questions as well. I guess those are what the sort of, and if you really need to, just crawl into bed for a day with a book. It's really okay.
I think that's great advice. I'm going to take them even without creative practice. So, James, what are you working on now and what ideas particularly are drawing your attention at the moment?
Yeah, well, I guess in the last 2 years I've been doing a lot of Kaurna cultural revival stuff, like learning and making traditional objects and thinking about how I make them into contemporary forms that we can have in our everyday spaces. So I've been working for the last 2 years on foods from the Kaurna area. So I think I've tried about 60 or 70 different edible plants that are within that one area of South Australia. And I'm putting together a cookbook that uses mostly only indigenous ingredients. Probably about one third of the ingredients are Kaurna, and then there's a few spices and stuff. And then only because you can't get an indigenous grain commercially at the moment, you can get kangaroo grass, but not commercially. But I think it should probably come up in the next 10 years. And there's a wild rice to make a flatbread. And I'm making these foods with indigenous ingredients in a Johnny cake. And yeah, then having them at openings, at exhibition openings, selling it as a cookbook. But I'm also making utensils to go with it, like a Kaurna knife, which is based off a stone knife made out of metal, but with the same short handle, rolling pins, repurposing contemporary, like historical clubs into rolling pins, grindstones, rethinking them, how they could be in our contemporary everyday space, and what would Kaurna cooking utensils in a contemporary space be, and how can they add something into our, you know, human objects, you know, how do they fit into our contemporary space and our contemporary kitchen. So, yeah, that's kind of what I've been working on. So it's looking at cultural, like reviving historical cultural knowledge and then bringing it into a contemporary space where it can be rethought and, yeah, just become normal within our everyday life. Yeah.
So if people want to follow your work or find a bit more about the body of work you've already produced, how can they do that?
Yeah, so you can access it through my website, which is just my name, jamestyler.com, and Tyler spelled T-Y-L-O-R, not E-R. And you can also get me on Instagram as well. That's for stuff that's more what I'm working on in the here and now. But yes, the cookbook should hopefully be out by the end of the year and you should be able to access it either by my website or you might be able to find it in art galleries around the country.
And Danielle, what's next for you?
Well, I'm working at the New South Wales Government Architects Office on a fantastic and really exciting project called the Sydney Ochre Grid. It's a project to map Aboriginal sites in Sydney, both pre-colonial and shared history sites. I think it's a really important project for somebody, especially for Sydney as the point of first impact. But also I'm very interested in mapping not only as how it can help us as Aboriginal people, but how it's been used against us as colonial tools. So I'm doing background research for that project, and I'm also finishing off my PhD, which is quite related, so it's an exciting to link the two. And I'm doing some other cultural mapping work for City of Sydney at the moment, just a small project, but that's really nice as well to be working around where I am. I think it's really important to work in the location you are rather than, well, to me anyway, as part of my ideals is work where you are, try and make a difference where I am. That's the main crux of, and a bit of teaching here and there where I get it. But yeah, that's the main crux of what I'm working on at the moment.
Is there a way people can follow your work?
My website, danielhromek.com, it's being redeveloped at the moment, so it's a little bit messy, but stick with it, it'll come back. that's the main site for contact.
And Emily, finally this evening, you did speak about the fact that the exhibition is actually going to be moving. Can you tell us a little bit about what is next for it and how people can follow the exhibition as it travels?
So I've really thought about this exhibition at UTS as the nucleus of ideas. So it's in advance of a year from its next venue, which will be in Bathurst in 2019. And it will then embark on a 9-venue tour across Australia. So those dates will be on the website of Museums and Galleries New South Wales. And I think I'll be touring that until 2022. And, you know, it's been a very big year. It started with 4,000 fish, and I've had 3 exhibitions this year. And so it'll be great to create some space around that and allow those conversations to resonate. And for me, what I'm sitting with, the ideas at the end of the year, are around how important memory is, and the activation and the body in space, and how we physically interact with our histories. So perhaps that might turn into further study, but for the moment, I think I'm just going to let those ideas rest and have time to breathe and see how they might manifest next.
So once again, the silences are as important as the words.
Always.
My guests this evening have been artist and curator Emily McDaniel, Ghana artist James Tyler, and Butterwong and Yuin artist and designer Danielle Romick. We've been exploring the concept of void, the title of a new exhibition curated by Emily and featuring the work of both James and Danielle. That's the show for this week. Join us again next week when we'll bring you a discussion from the New South Wales Reconciliation Group arguing the case for an Indigenous treaty. Speaking Out is on Facebook, and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au. We would love to hear from you. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out. We'll be right back.